but they're not human-centered. They're animal and species, other species-centered, in which we share this precious planet. You were going to talk about Thomas Aquinas, but you also have some more quotes that are relevant from Thomas Berry.
Yes, yes. It speaks to what you were speaking of just a moment ago. To understand, everything is connected. So he says, the earth exists and can survive only in its integral functioning. It cannot survive in fragments any more than any organism can survive in fragments. I mean, that's really clear. You know, when people start talking about, oh, you know, we can afford to get rid of this and get rid of that, and we don't really need that. That's just like saying, oh, well, you know, let's chop off a limb, or what member of your family do you want to, you know, sacrifice? It's a whole. So I love that quote. And that comes from Selected Writings on the Earth Community. That's Thomas Berry's writing. And then moving on to Thomas Aquinas, which was really when Thomas Berry, I heard him quote this, it really put everything into perspective for me. He says, because the divine could not image itself forth in any one being, it created the great diversity of things, so that what was lacking in one would be supplied by the others, and the whole universe together would participate in and manifest the divine more than any single being whatsoever.
Wow. Yeah, exactly.
So this idea of the larger self, you know, that's Joanna Macy talks about that. That's what it is. It's one self, and we're a part of it.
And we are part of it. And so it's really important to know that going beyond our own particular species and going beyond looking at Earth as a resource and to be dug up and to be exploited, it's like joining in a kinship. That seems like what you're going for in the cards themselves, is to show our kinship to even the smallest cells of plankton, which are so important on the earth today, so we can contemplate that as well.
Yes, it's called interbeing. That's Thich Nhat Hanh's and the Buddhist idea that everything is, you know, it's one, and we're different articulations of that one life.
And I love it that when you go to the QR code in the actual card, and then you find these resources that help us take action if we're inspired for that. And I think it's important because that's an important part of it. It's not just that we passively do look at the card, we're inspired, we journal, and then we can take action. And when I looked at some of the actions and some of the resources that you include in the book and in the cards and in your writing, one of the things that really popped out at me that I think is so important as we work towards the earth and a better relationship, we might be also making it impossible for some people to survive. You know what I mean? That like if we say, okay, we're going to save this forest. For example, the monarch butterfly, it has a home. In the winter, it spends in Mexico. And then the local people, because some of them are in poverty, they come and they cut down trees that, I think, oilamel trees that are necessary for the butterflies to be there all winter long, and they do that in clusters. And they need the trees to be kind of close together, otherwise it gets too cold. So what happens when we say, okay, you can't go in the forest and cut that down anymore? Well, how do these people survive? And that's the other part of it, that it's a whole piece. So we have to help people survive with shelter. If we're going to take away their livelihood, we've got to do something else. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that's something that I go into and fairly in depth in the guidebook, because Jane Goodall has done this with several programs where working with the local community, she understood that very well, that she wasn't going to save chimpanzees if she couldn't save their habitat. So she worked with the local people in ways that would help safeguarding the habitat was also helping the local communities. The saying is conservation benefits when people benefit from conservation. So there isn't really, we're not pitted against the earth. We're not, you know, our survival depends on everything getting along. One of my favorite stories is from the Maasai tribe, for whom killing a lion was once a rite of passage for males to achieve their warrior status. So the Maasais are also herders, and to keep their herds safe, instead of hunting down lions, which is what they used to do, they have become protectors of lions. They're called lion guardians. And these guardians find and name lions, and using radio telemetry, keep track of their numbers and warn herders of the lion's presence. So today, being a lion guardian bestows even more prestige than killing a lion. So there are many, many examples of this, where getting people involved with, there's stories about elephants, there's all kinds of ways that local communities now are working with the environment to sustain themselves. And I forget how many, what percentage of humans, indigenous people, are actually guarding the last wild places. So they are to be helped. They're not, where nobody is in direct competition with the earth. That's a misconception.
I'm remembering when you say wild places, I remember years ago when we interviewed Edward Abbey, and he was saying, we need to protect wilderness areas even from humans, you know, because when humans go into these wilderness areas, they bring with them these other species like crows or blue jays or something that are not indigenous. And they kind of follow us as humans because they know that we're going to give them some, you know, food or something that they need. And so they're always following us. So he was saying, not even humans in wilderness areas. Leave that to the species that are indigenous to those areas.
Mm-hmm. And the cultures, that are indigenous too, because we kicked the Indians out of Yellowstone, you know, and they help, you know, the indigenous people help maintain the balance, you know. So it's not necessarily that all humans are destructive. Like, I want to go on an African safari, but when I see what they do with these jeeps, you know, the 50 jeeps that are, you know, trying to get a good shot of, like, the wildebeest, you know, and they block their migration routes, you know, that's not the type of thing we need. I mean, if we're going to have ecotourism, or whatever they call it, it has to be wise. It cannot, again, you know, every decision we make has to be measured against the well-being of other species and not just humans, because that eventually is going to come back and kick us, you know.
Exactly. I'm thinking about your introduction to ecological spirituality. And that I think you write about this, that it was attending, when you first attended a Sundance ritual in the Southern Ute reservation. This was back in the 1980s, I believe, when you discovered like the ecological spirituality.
Well, the American Indians, their spirituality is earth-based. So, when I attended the Sundance in preparation for the Sundance, which takes place over 4 days, where the Sundancers fast from food and water and dance constantly until they lose all their power, and so it's the spirit that has to inhabit them in order to continue. And then the idea is to be blessed with some kind of vision, which then you can bring to the, back to the people and for the healing of the earth. So in preparation for that, not only the Sundancers, but the people who were invited to be witnesses, or to support the Sundancers, you get to do sweat lodges. And the sweat lodge is, they have their own liturgical materials, like we would have bread and wine, you know, for the mass. And for the sweat lodge, it's water, earth, stone, and steam. They make this, the Sundance Lodge is very, it's low to the ground and it's made out of saplings, and it's covered with tarp and blankets, and you go in and it's like you're in the womb. They close the flap and you're in there, and it's pitch dark, and it gets really hot because they have these rocks that they've been heating up in a fire outside the sweat lodge. They bring them in, and then the person who officiates starts to pour water on the rocks, and you get so humble, and it's really uncomfortable, and you can't help, you have to pray. It's very much like the Sundance. It's an ordeal. You're very uncomfortable, and when I first experienced a real earth-based form of prayer and a spirituality, and you know, I've always had a great affection for, you know, the indigenous people of the Turtle Island, you know, and so yeah, I was very privileged, but it did affect me very deeply, you know.
As you say, you're almost forced to just sort of disappear in some way. I remember I've done Sweat Lodge, and there were moments when all I could do was just lay down on the earth, just put my head down as low as I could, and so I'm just on the earth. My body is all on the earth. And so coming out of the sweat lodge, what was that like as you leave the sweat lodge?
Well, you know, there, you're always near a body of water. Usually in Colorado, it's a creek or a stream, and at night, it's just breathtaking, you know. So it's very, very hot in there, and then you come out, and you're usually wearing some kind of light clothing, not very much, and you see the stars. It's like being reborn into the universe, and then you can cold plunge, which is really something, you know, because the streams there are cold because it's coming off the mountains. So this, unless you're near a hot spring, it's all very cold water. So yeah, it's like being reborn.
Yes. And this ritual, Sundance ritual, continues on today. Witnessing is very active. It's not like, oh, you're just there and watching this movie or something. No, it's very active, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when you're the Sundance is they have a corral that's in the middle, and that's where all the Sundancers are kind of seated around. And then it's encircled by these shade lodges where the families are of the Sundancers are. And so you could be asked as a part of the family, or just an invited guest, to go get like cattails for the Sundancers so that they could sit on something cool, because the cattails are very cool and you have to pick them a certain way. You can't cut them, you have to twist them. And it's just, you're just a part of this amazing ceremony. And I've been up to the Lakota Sundance where they do piercing, and that's even more intense. It's more intense. And
Yes.
you
So
well
the person who's actually doing the dance takes the whole community there to a whole nother level of being with the earth and being concerned with the earth and being concerned about being part of this whole panoply of life on this precious planet. So it's a real privilege to be an honor to be at one of these ceremonies.
Yes, I felt that very deeply.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did. So if what can you say about other practices that we might do to connect us to the kinship of all of life? Do you have any personal practices that you do?
Well, mostly just being in nature. I don't have a specific practice, but I would say that I see that you've interviewed John Seed, and one of the he's got the Council of All Beings, which is really quite something. I've done Vision Quest with Joan Halifax, where you're out for 24, 48 hours, but it's not something you do every day, because you can't, I'd be a wreck, but so they're only done, intermittently. Let's
Well, I'm
see.
thinking too, if you're doing these rituals, let's say like a vision quest, you might take actual years to integrate that expression, that activity with what came to you. I mean, I know I did a vision quest and it took me years to integrate it fully at ease with the chaos. I think we started, you said that the first part of the painting is the chaos part. So tell me how is it that you cope with the chaos?
Not very well.
I think we're all struggling with it. Angela, all of us are struggling with that and working with it. And that's what's so wonderful about the cards, because they bring a kind of presence, and then we have to integrate it. We have to really think about it, write about it, and then you give us a place to take action. And I often say we don't have the luxury of despair these days, and that's hard. That's hard against what we're working against, especially in these times as we enter 2026, and it's not easy.
Well, I love, do you know the biologist Sandra Steingraber? Do you know her?
No, I don't know her.
Oh,
Tell
you
us
would
about
like
her.
her. She's a Quaker and a biologist, and she went to jail for nonviolent resistance. She was against fracking up in the Finger Lakes area, and just before she went to jail, she was interviewed by Bill Moyers. She called it well-informed futility. And the only antidote is meaningful action. So, we know, we hear all about what's happening. It's I don't know if I would even call that chaos. I would call it deliberate destruction. And so the way to pull yourself out of that, I mean, it's okay to be in grief and despair and all that. That's part of the human, range of emotions. But meaningful action, just find something that you care about and then live your life that demonstrates, that you're care and concern. That's why I have these QR codes, so that when people say they do experience grief or anger or fear or whatever, they can then find a place to put their energy to make a difference. And we really, I mean, we all need to actually participate. It's not, we can't just leave it up to experts. I believe that everyone needs to get involved and just pick something that you really care about, because we're losing ground, as far as like species extinction goes. And Jane Goodall says we have to swell the ranks. We have
Oh,
to swell the
right.
ranks. And she's absolutely right. So my intention with this book, actually, and the cards, is to reach a new demographic. The people who use oracles and tarot cards and things like that, because there's an element of action here, and social action, environmental action, that hopefully will stimulate, more involvement, from a larger demographic. So
I
that's my
know
hope.
that I'm one of those persons. I love oracle cards, tarot cards. I mean, I have all these decks. Some of them are right here on my desk. I mean, I just got a new deck from Mark Nepo, and oh, I love his work, and I was excited about that. And then I got from the publisher these the diversity cards by the Sacred Diversity Oracle. I thought, oh, goody. But what really got me was Bill McKibben said, these are really great cards. Use them, go for it. And to take someone who's such a strict sort of environmentalist and activist, environmental activist, and he's tough, I have to say. Bill McKibben is tough. And when he said these oracle cards are worth pursuing, that just, wow, just gave me a real lift. And he was right. He's absolutely right. And when you talk about being active, I think it's important to know that whatever action we are doing is of benefit, and we don't have to worry about, oh, this is just too small and I'm not making any difference. No, do it anyway and not be concerned about the outcome. The outcome might be years in the making.
Yes, and that's what Jane Goodall in her last days, she emphasized that over and over again, that every person makes a difference. And of course, if you band together with others, it multiplies your actions. But I wanted to again quote Thomas Berry about this from his book The Great Work. We all have our particular work besides the particular work we do. The particular lives we lead, we have a great work that everyone is involved in and no one is exempt from. The great work before us is the task of moving modern industrial civilization from its present devastating influence on Earth to a more benign mode of presence. It is not a role we have chosen. We were chosen by some power beyond ourselves for this historic task. We are, as it were, thrown into existence with a challenge and a role that is beyond any personal choice. The nobility of our lives, however, depends upon the manner in which we come to understand and fulfill our assigned role.
is so beautifully said, Thomas Berry. I'm thinking it's really going back to our origins here in the U.S. is we the people, and that's where the power is, we the people. I want to thank you so much, Angela, for being with us today on New Dimensions. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Angela Mano, and she is the creator of the Sacred Biodiversity Oracle. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, angelamano.com, and she spells her last name M-A-N-N-O, angelamano.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website. That's newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3856.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. This staccato call tells us there's a yellow-billed cuckoo nearby. One of two species of cuckoos in the woodlands of North America. The yellow-billed lives in broadleaf forests throughout the east and riparian stands in the southwest. They were common breeding birds in the Pacific Northwest as late as the 1920s, but then they disappeared. Ornithologists still don't know why. The black-billed cuckoo is a more northerly species living in dense woodland, even conifer forests. Cuckoos perch quietly and scan their surroundings for food. Hairy tent caterpillars, shunned by most birds, are often on their meal ticket. So, if you have an infestation of tent caterpillars, you might see one of these slender brown and white birds with long white-spotted tails. The cuckoo plucks a caterpillar from its tent and manipulates it back and forth in its bill, taking off many of the bothersome hairs. But some of them remain, and cuckoo stomachs are sometimes lined with these hairs. When the hairs are dense enough to prevent digestion, the entire stomach lining is cast off and regurgitated. Nature finds surprising ways to deal with problems. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.